This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Hi, Ages and Icons listeners. This is Gina B. I just wanted to give you a fair warning that in today's episode, there is a little bit of swearing. The F word happens to be right in the title of a book we're discussing. So if you have any kids in the car or pets that are easily offended, I suggest you put earmuffs on them. All right, enjoy the show.
Okay, intro. Bum, 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 bum. Maybe I should just a cappella the intros.
You could try if you want. Can you carry it for like 30 seconds?
I can carry it for 10 seconds. Let's try it again. Bum bum bida bee bee ba ba dee boop boop ba ba. Mike is gonna intro us right now.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Ages and Icons. I'm Mike Crisolago.
And I'm Mikey's sidekick, Gina Bucci.
The human beatbox over there.
Well, that wasn't beatboxing, Mike.
Well, not,
you know. It's very white of you. That was doo-wop or bebop.
Okay, what I mean is vocalizing music.
Yeah. Vague terms, Mike. Very good. Generic. If you're listening to us on everythingzoomer.com, our podcast, of course, is Ages and Icons. Please make sure that you find us on whatever podcast app that you love and listen to. So that could be iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. We're on all three. And subscribe, like us, review, tell your friends, tell your neighbor, tell your cats, tell your dog, tell your grandma.
We read all the reviews. We check out every like. Our egos are fragile over here. So please, likes and good reviews.
Guys, Mike's begging you, okay? Just do it. It's sad. It's sad to watch. And I don't want to watch it anymore. I don't want to see this anymore. Make him happy. He's a good guy. So this week, Mike spoke to Daryl Hammond. He called him on the phone. Now, I just actually want to address the elephant in the room. We have had some audio issues with phone calls in the past. We have since solved that, I believe, successfully. So I apologize for the David Sedaris phone call. It was a big one because that was very popular. And
you gotta let it go, Gina. You gotta let it go. It's in the past.
But you know what? You gotta acknowledge these things.
Yeah, we fixed it. We're good now.
I'm just gonna tell the audience, I'm aware we have fixed the issue. Not to worry. This Daryl Hammond call, you know, he was on his cell phone. So you hear some phone stuff. You can't avoid that. But it's much crisper, much cleaner. On Ages and Icons, we're going to make all of our audio issues, I believe, have been wrinkled out. Well, they were wrinkled. They've been ironed out for you, the listener. So we're aware of that. We hear you. Thank you so much. We think that's solved. And if it happens again, I'm sorry. It might in the future. Who knows? Depends, you know. Mike gets a call out of the blue and we can't book a studio. What's it going to say? No?
Yeah. And you know? See, you can tell how much it means to Gina, how hard
Elton John calls, and Mike's going to be like, no, I can't talk to you, no.
I would communicate with Elton John by smoke signal if I had to.
In the spirit
world,
you would.
Absolute favorite.
Yeah.
Daryl Hammond was a blast to talk to. Of course, he's a Saturday Night Live mainstay for 14 years. Now he's the announcer replacing the late Don Pardo. But he called us, and we were talking about his new audiobook. It's an audiobook of his 2011 memoir called God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Fucked. It's
Mike, when someone searches that online, mm-hmm. would they type in the full F
word? The F word has an asterisk in the middle of the,
so is that
instead
what they
of a
type?
U, but I'm not sure how to pronounce the F word with an asterisk.
Well, Audible lists it as God, if you're up there, I'm F asterisk.
If you're not up there.
Oh, yeah. God, sorry. God, if you're not up there, I'm F asterisk.
C-K-E-D.
C-K-E-D. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's how you spell it.
So, yeah, it's his 2011 memoir. He's releasing it now on audiobook through Audible, as well as a sort of a collection of funny stories, a separate release called That's Clinton. It's a collection of funny stories and just little anecdotes from his life and career that it's not really a stand-up routine, but he is sort of performing them in front of an audience. So that's also coming up as well in Audible in early August. So we wanted to talk to him about both of those things.
That's amazing. You know, when I love Hammond on SNL, obviously an incredible Clinton impression, still does it.
Yeah.
It's very convenient for SNL to have him there in studio announcing. so you can drop it. Even his Trump impression is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. And we talk about it in the interview. He's like the one person who's done an impression of Trump where Trump actually tweeted and applauded it, said that they should replace Alec Baldwin and bring back Daryl Hammond.
Yeah, but Trump applauds a lot of questionable people.
I know. So. This is finally somebody that we can agree on is talented, that Trump also thinks is talented.
Yeah, but it makes me question everything now. I'm like, is Daryl Hammond evil?
No.
Could he be?
You know what's funny about Daryl Hammond that I was thinking about earlier? He's been doing, well, he did SNL for 14 years, and he's second only to Kenan Thompson, as you pointed out before we went on the air, who's the longest tenured cast member. Mm-hmm. So 14 years, and yet when you think about, hey, name a legendary SNL member. Through no fault of Daryl Hammond's, I don't think he is one of the first that usually comes to mind. Usually people think of Bill Murray or Chevy Chase or Gilda Radner or Tina Fey or Will Ferrell, on and on and on. Because I think Daryl Hammond was so good at his impressions that he almost became the characters. And I know it's in a satirical way. He's not like going to walk out on the street as Sean Connery and people are going to think it's actually Sean Connery. But you get so lost in the impression that you almost like forget about the man behind it. Like when I was interviewing him, I forgot for a while that, oh my God, yeah, he's the one who did Sean Connery in those Celebrity Jeopardy skits. That's amazing. He's always making fun of Alex Trebek. And an interesting point, I know we're going to touch on it later, but he used to do Al Gore. And apparently after the first presidential debate in 2000, when Gore was debating George W. Bush, Gore's people made him watch a skit of Daryl Hammond doing Al Gore so that Al Gore would see, hey, this is what people think about you. This is how you're perceived. Because obviously the satire enhances the flaws of the person or some misgivings of the person. It's just that you get lost sometimes behind the impressions and you forget that there's a guy there. It's the same guy behind every person.
That's absolutely right, actually. I 100% agree with you, which is rare. I'm usually vehemently against everything Mike says.
I'm a little worried. Somewhere the devil is shivering down in hell.
In this case, you're totally right. And he also has one of those malleable faces, which you don't see his face.
Yeah.
Like Bill Hader is another terrific impressionist.
Oh, I love Bill Hader. Yeah.
But Hader's got a face that, for me anyway, I'm always aware I'm looking at Bill Hader.
Yes, exactly.
Even no matter how spot on his impression is, I'm always aware I'm looking at Bill Hader.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something about Daryl Hammond, that his face, he just kind of was a very, very good chameleon, which is an excellent thing for an actor and an excellent thing for an SNL cast member, especially in that role. Of impressionist. I remember, do you remember the 40th anniversary special? So he did it. The eyebrows were always different in every appearance as Sean Connery on Jeopardy. And there's, you know, when they would go to the categories, the category name was Who Reads? And he read it as Whore Ads. And one category was Let It Snow. And he read it as Letits Now.
Yes, Letits Now. I remember
Letits
that.
Letits Now. So funny.
There's another one. It may not have been from the 40th anniversary, where the pen is mightier.
Yeah.
And I feel like it was a penis mighty or something like that. And it's so good.
So good. Okay, so without further ado, here is Mike's interview with Daryl Hammond.
Hi there.
Hi, Daryl. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
No problem. Well, I wanted to get right into it because I know we have a lot to discuss, but I wanted to start with the audiobook of God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Fucked, which, I mean, aside from being hilarious and poignant, and it's like it's up and down as far as emotions go, I wanted to ask you about sort of recording it now, you know, sort of 7 years later after you originally published the book, and sort of what was the impetus for turning the memoir into an audiobook at this time?
I couldn't think of any reason not to turn it into an audiobook. And when you think of it, you think, well, gee, that's a great idea. I really would like to do that. Mm-hmm. That would be fun. There's a lot of voices in there. You know, there's a lot of performance in the audio book. I didn't understand how difficult it would be, but to be honest with you, after so many years of therapy and talking about these very same stories with so many doctors, it didn't really beat me up. The only thing that was hard was it was hard on my voice, but but it wasn't like haunting. I didn't go off the deep end or have any sort of relapse of any kind. It was just hard physically to do. It's a difficult. Reading books on tape is no joke. It's pretty hard, especially when you're performing, like every other paragraph, you have to perform a character and do it well. You know, not. And I thought it was pretty hard to do, but I'm really happy I did it.
Yeah, I was thinking that because you always hear people who authors who mention that they've recorded audiobooks, how long it can take and how difficult and arduous a task it is. And then you throw in characters on top of that.
Yeah, it's really hard. I had heard that as well, but I didn't. If you're sitting in a booth and you're using your voice and you're modifying your body and supporting your diaphragm and paying attention to every single word that you put out there, after 3 hours, that's old.
Yeah.
Well, wait till 6 hours, you know. very doable, but much harder than I thought it would be.
And yeah, and you sort of already touched on this, but I was going to ask you about sort of reliving some of the more painful moments from the book. That wasn't an issue for you, having to go back and sort of talk about it again?
I mean, I've been talking about those stories for years in therapy.
Yeah.
I was moved by some of it. I have to say, I think there's a point in there when I'm doing my father talking about Nazis, about the SS and a German soldier that he encountered, or things he said to troops before they would go into battle with the SS or the Germans. Mm-hmm. And I remember my voice breaking and getting moved, a little tearful as I read the piece, and I stopped it and I said, yeah, you know what, I'm going to do that over. They went, no. We're keeping that. Keep that one.
Yeah.
Because you're giving, like, you know, sort of a living performance of a dad talking about some pretty horrific things. And I guess I haven't heard it yet, but I hope it's okay, you know?
Yeah, and it's, I'm always curious, and it's interesting you mentioned that sort of the emotion, because I'm always curious what it's like for someone with a memoir who then puts it on an audiobook. Especially as you did years later, if you look back on some of these things that you know about, obviously you lived them, you talked about them many times, if you sort of learn anything about yourself, sort of reliving it now with some distance between writing the book and recording it.
I didn't learn anything from the book. You know, the book, there was probably 100 pages of notes that never quite made it into the book because I didn't get to get, oh, because I got hit by a car. Yeah, I was in a car accident. And so they thought they had enough to go with a book, you know, and they were right. I mean, it became a New York Times bestseller, but it's probably 100 pages of notes. It didn't make it into the book where I talk about all the stuff I learned during that process. But, you know, look, it sounds really banal to say it, but I'm learning stuff all the time about myself, and some of it isn't so hot.
Yeah.
You know, there's always room for self-examination and improvement. I didn't do anything like that for the first part of my life, and I try to do it now, as uncomfortable as it is sometimes.
Yeah. What about the reaction that will ultimately come from people who listen to the book? Do you have the same sort of feelings putting out the audiobook that perhaps you had when you were putting out the physical book into the world, as far as what people will think or if they're coming upon this story for the first time?
I wonder if it's more effective reading it. I don't know. I mean, I haven't heard it yet. And I'm very curious. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm sorry.
No problem. Of course, a lot of people, when they come to the book or the audiobook or what have you, they'll know you mostly probably from your work on Saturday Night Live, having been the longest tenured member and in setting so many records, which I didn't even realize until I was sort of doing some research for this interview. The record for saying live from New York the most times. The one thing that sort of stood out, especially for Zoomer, given our sort of our focus on aging and the 45 plus demo, is that you also hold the record as the oldest cast member in history at 53 when you left in 2009.
Right. It was very uncommon to hire someone at the age of 39. Hmm. You know, I started my dream to be on SNL when I was 27. At that time, I decided that if I made, I got this from Tony Robbins, the life coach, that if you make small incremental changes every single week of your life, at the end of the year, that's 52 improvement. Mm-hmm. So when I started wanting to get good enough to be on SNL, it was a fantasy. I had a fantasy, and I pursued it. But I became convinced after a while that if I practiced 5 days, 6 days a week, made one improvement a week, that after a number of years, maybe I would be good enough that despite my age, they would take me on the show anyway. Because, you know, this is a show for young folks. Mm-hmm. Not that 39 is necessarily old. It's not. But for that show, it is.
Yeah.
So maybe that's one of the best achievements I ever did, is I went out there with the young'uns and competed and was able to do pretty well.
Oh, it's incredible. And I was wondering, too, if as you moved into your 40s and into your 50s and were still a cast member on the show, if your age as compared to your castmates who are much younger, if there was any sort of, I don't know if it's an advantage, but if it gave you a certain comic sensibility or sensibility within the show that maybe a younger actor or performer doesn't have.
I don't know. I know that the more times you do sketches in that theater, in that format, the better you get at it. I know I wasn't very good my first year. I started to get better my second year. But I really didn't get comfortable out there on camera until my third or fourth year. So maybe there's an advantage just from sheer experience, you know?
Yeah. Now, of course, you also became known for all of your impressions. Obviously, most famously, Bill Clinton, but everybody, Sean Connery, Al Gore, and on and on. You had my friends and I literally in tears one time doing Chris Matthews, talking about Dick Armey and going on. There was a sketch. I cannot find it online, but I remember being on tears watching it on TV. But
yeah, I remember the sketch.
Yeah, you remember. And Chris, and all the other names, Chris, that you were mocking him.
Chris Kattan played Paul Begalia. I forgot who played Dick Armey. It's been a while, but yeah, I remember it. I really loved doing that sketch.
Yeah, no, we were in tears, but I mean, I'm just wondering for you as a performer, both what's your most, what was your favorite impression to do and perhaps what was the most difficult?
Well, the most difficult one was Newt Gingrich. I couldn't even come close to it. They ended up putting me out there because it was good enough to do one or two lines and they needed that in the sketch, and it's difficult, not because it's abnormal. It's difficult because I had never done a voice like that before, and there wasn't time to learn it, you know. Mm-hmm. Just a few hours. Even if you get your assignment on Wednesday, that doesn't mean you're going to have 3 days to learn it.
Right.
You're going to be doing so many other things, you know. So you run out of time sometimes when you're preparing those characters trying to go to air.
And did you have a favorite?
I never did Al Sharpton on the air. But that's my favorite to do in live performance. And I hate to say it, but by the time I'd done Clinton for 4 or 5 years, he really started to explore all the different sides of that guy.
Yeah.
That had to be the most thrilling thing you could possibly do.
Yeah, and I mean, now you're still with SNL and serving as an announcer, replacing Don Pardo, which I would have to imagine is in some ways a monumental task to follow up a television legend like that in the same role.
Well, the way it was presented to me was the way we're going to replace Don Pardo is we're not going to replace him. We're not going to hire another announcer.
Yeah.
we're going to say he's the greatest announcer ever, and he's not replaceable. So we're going to hire his friend Daryl to come in here and do an announcer. Daryl's not an announcer. So it was sort of, the whole thing was meant to be an homage to Pardo. And in the very beginning, and we still do this sometimes, we made sure we colored some of the vowels as a tribute to Don. For instance, when I say featuring, you know, in the very beginning we would always do featuring, you know, and it was just a way of tipping the hat saying, we love you, Don. We're never, we can't replace you and we don't want to, but here's your friend out here doing it. doing his best to get it done.
Do you just enjoy being on set there at SNL now in a different role and hanging out with everybody still?
It's pretty enjoyable without the, there's no pressure.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to be doing my thing. I know I'm going to be in the show. It's kind of nice to be around everyone and just shoot the breeze and have coffee and talk with people and spend a few minutes with people that I've known in some instances for 15 or 20 years.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I wanted to just mention that you're one of those few people I know that you had started impersonating Donald Trump years ago, and you were one of those few people who actually got a compliment from him, oddly enough, on
yeah.
your impersonation. Which must seem a little bit surreal, given nobody really gets a compliment on him from him for doing an impersonation.
It's pretty bizarre to be, you know, sort of walking around your house being this this normal, challenged person, and realizing the president just did something that has people in Ghana saying your name. You know, they're talking about you in Beijing today, Daryl. The president is talking about you on Twitter. That was hard to wrap my mind around. But as with so many things about SNL, you know, describing some of those experiences, it's a lot like trying to describe the Grand Canyon. I really can't.
Yeah.
I'll try. Paul McCartney was here. The llama was here. The tap dancers were here. And then LeBron James walked in. How do I describe what that's like?
Right.
I don't know.
It's a day at the office.
Yeah.
Speaking of presidents, you have your another Audible release coming up called That's Clinton, which isn't really a stand-up, right? It's more of it's an assortment of stories from your book.
Right. There were stories from the book that we hoped would be funny. we hoped they'd be funny stories. So I think there were 10 of them. We took them out in front of an audience. And told the stories, and you know what? Some of them were funny. All of them weren't, but we didn't include those in the recording.
You have the one again, just sort of thinking about stuff we often talk about here and health and wellness, and you have your colonoscopy story, which is hilarious, and how Bill Clinton sort of popped out. And
yeah, it really is, you know, and. You know, you're in this procedure, this very invasive procedure, for a very, very serious reason, and you've got that on your mind. And this anesthesia, I was struggling a little bit during the procedure, and the anesthesiologist walked in the room and looked at me and went, she said, "What would Clinton say?" So I thought, Wow, that's insane. Even in this procedure, with this highfalutin Upper East Side doc, Bill Clinton still walks in the room.
And if people listen to That's Clinton, they can find out what Bill Clinton would say, actually, which is funny. the answer to the question, which you deliver. Do you get approached a lot by people asking you to do, you know, Clinton or whoever?
In the beginning, it was Duke Clinton for me. years later, they do their Clinton for you.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to me last week. I was in New Orleans. It comes in flurries. People come up, or they do their Sean Connery impression, or they'll do their Clinton impression. See that a lot, and that's from coast to coast. That sort of thing happens. It's very interesting.
I think you and on That's Clinton, you told a story about somebody yelling like a Sean Connery impression at you, like to make fun of you or something to that effect, like the way that Connery would make fun of Trebek.
I was walking down Broadway one night around 41st Street over by the New York Times building, and someone walked out of a little restaurant there and yelled out, "Moo! Moo!" like that. And I go, "What is that?" And the guy said, "That's the sound your mother makes." You know, and, and again, you know, you sort of do a take to an unseen camera and go, "What is that? And help me understand this." You know? Help me understand this planet I live on sometimes.
I find it funny to think that if you were, you know, starting out as a comedian and somebody could have flashed forward and showed you the future and said, in, you know, 30 years, this is going to be an experience you have on the street, and trying to figure out where the heck is that coming from.
Yeah.
It's so strange.
Yeah, if you were getting a glimpse into your future, you would be utterly baffled that someone came out and celebrated, meet them, that they're celebrating you by yelling out, "Moo." Yeah, you're right. A little weird.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about if you're working in comedy today and compared to when you were younger, when you were starting out and coming up, and even before SNL and through it, if your sensibility for what inspires you for comedy or how you create your comedy has changed as you've gotten older compared to when you're younger.
Yeah, I mean, as I got older, I began to realize that people in the crowd, you know, I started to get a sense of good people looking at the same picture, seeing different things. That I'm talking about Democrats and Republicans, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I realized I didn't want to hurt them, you know. I always try to do character-driven stuff that, you know, I do Dick Cheney hitting a golf ball, and Republicans can laugh at that, too. And mm-hmm. that sort of became what was described as my middle-of-the-road approach to comedy. I always tried to say something nice about the person before I actually made fun of them, you know? So maybe that's not a hard... I think in this era now, when I go out and do stand-up, for instance, if you're going to do Trump, you have to... you either got to cut his head off or you got to exalt him to the stars because there's no middle of the road. There's no way for me to get Trump lovers and Trump haters to laugh at the same joke
right. In
the same way it used to be in the past.
And do you find yourself when you go out and do stand-up, do you still get the same nerves, the same jitters that you used to when you were younger?
No. I take my friend Kendall Ketchum with me. We have a good time out there. I enjoy it. I know the material. You know, I've been doing stand-up a while now.
Yeah.
I've got a little experience out there, and so I'm a little bit more... I'm actually a lot more comfortable when I'm out there, and I can actually have some fun with it.
Nice. No, I'm glad to hear it. And I wanted to ask you quickly about aging well, because we do talk a lot about that here at Zoomer, and I know, and you've talked about it in your book, and even in this interview, you've discussed struggles and sort of dealing with it and trying to better yourself. And so I was wondering if, you know, through that, through your own experiences, if you have any advice for our listeners and our readers as far as aging well up into your 50s and 60s and so forth.
I don't know if this will be helpful for anyone, but what I discovered was, you know, there was a time in my life when I would go to the gym and I wanted to look like Brad Pitt, or I wasn't going to be happy. You know, I wanted to be thin and buff and lean, and I wanted to run 3 miles, and you know, or I wouldn't be happy. You know, that made it too hard to go to the gym.
Yeah.
You know, the way I approach it now is I want to get good checkups from the doctor. I want my cholesterol to be enough that the doctor says it's okay. I want my blood pressure to be good. You know, I know I'm a few pounds overweight. I'm not so svelte. But, hey, the doc says I'm doing good. So the thing that I discovered was that the first 5 minutes are the only hard part. The rest of it, you just do it. But it's like that first 5 minutes when your body is refusing to accept what your brain is telling it to do. You just go to the gym and go, okay, I'm only doing 10 minutes today. Also, there are yoga tapes. You know, I can't do yoga. I'm the most inflexible human in the world. But there are some yoga poses that I do in the morning when I'm listening to positive thinking messages, you know. Some people like Abraham Hicks or Wayne Dyer, whoever the person is that you like, you know, let that set the tone. I let that set the tone for my day. And I'll do these yoga stretches, and I'll breathe. And, you know, I'm not throwing a knockout punch or competing with anyone. Once I could let go and go, Daryl, it's really okay to not look like Brad Pitt. It's okay, all right? People still like you. You still have friends. Interestingly enough, when I was trying to look like Superman, my health was not good. Now that I'm doing it 3 or 4 times a week, my health is pretty good. Nice. You know, I've got to watch my carbs intake and all of that. But my friend is a nude model for NYU Art Students League. He's in his 60s. And I say to him, what's the key here, man? He goes, listen, I say to myself, I'm in my 60s. I mean, how good am I supposed to look? All right, I don't kill myself at the gym anymore. I just show up and I do a nice moderate workout.
Yeah.
You know, that was a hard thing for me to learn.
Oh, well, I'm glad you learned it. I really am.
And then another person told me, hey, if you can lie down on the floor and stand up, just do that every day, you know, and do that a few times. And there's some yoga postures for that. Move. The more I move, and the main thing for me is sweating.
Yeah.
The more I sweat, you know, Epsom salt baths, I take one almost every day just for the sweat, you know.
Oh, wow.
So that's my little thing.
Nice.
Oh, and avocados are good. Avocados are, apparently I don't have, I have a smooth skin because I eat avocados. I don't know if that's true or not, but everyone always tells me that.
What goals do you still have for your career going forward?
I don't know about my career. I don't know. I kind of did what I wanted to do, and so you're sort of faced with sitting here, and I have a comfortable apartment, and I'm looking out the window in New York City, and I don't have anything to do. It was a little bit weird to not have a race to run or a mountain to climb or a fire to put out or a dragon to slay. You know, sitting here going, people say to you, hey, you did it. You know, they say, you're an SNL legend or you're an SNL icon or whatever. Okay, all right, I did it. But now what do? And I don't really know. I know that I'm doing, I'm raising money for children's advocacy centers. I'm going to speak to some people in Congress in September. There's a movie about my book coming out very soon. And in fact, next week I'm going to a film festival that Michael Moore is putting on in Michigan where they're going to show a movie about the book that I wrote.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what I do with myself. I try to stay busy, but, you know, it doesn't always work. Sometimes I end up just watching TV all day, and I guess that's not always a good thing.
Not always, but I appreciate that you took some time today to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And congratulations on the audiobook. It's a wonderful listen, and I look forward to jumping into the rest of the stories in That's Clinton as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we're back. Good interview, Mike.
Thank you.
So the book is on Audible.
Audible. It's a mouthful.
Audible. Actually, it's kind of fun to say Audible right now. And it's called God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Effed. And there's also a collection of short stories, kind of his stand-up thingy called That's Clinton.
It's more of casual than stand-up, just him telling stories, riffing on things about his life called That's Clinton, yeah. It's a great companion piece, actually. You get a little more relaxed and off-the-cuff version of some of the stories from the audiobook.
So the audiobook, God, if you're not up there, I'm aft, is kind of dark. Actually, not kind of, pretty dark, but also, you know, littered with a lot of great impressions that that he does, that Hammond does throughout it. So, I mean, it's kind of fun, but you will be navigated through some dark places.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking, actually. It's not just necessarily your normal, I got drunk and passed out and woke up under the freeway or something. You know, it's...
Yeah, that's normal. That's a
normal
Tuesday
celebrity,
night.
Not normal. Like, I didn't do that this weekend. But you know, like... As you mentioned earlier, he had abuse from childhood that he has been dealing with his whole life. And I know even you and I were talking about some of the stuff he would do on SNL backstage, sort of how he would take it out on himself and how his demons would reveal themselves. And they're pretty shocking.
Yeah, that story is messed up. He did that great Al Gore impression at the debate. You were talking about that, how the Al Gore camp used it as a reference. Like, don't do this. But just before that performance, he actually cut his arm up like so badly that he had to gauze it. And right after the show, he had to go to the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, like he not cut like he accidentally slipped and fell. Like he was cutting it himself. Like
if you're watching Sharp Objects right now, oh man, it's hard to watch. Amy Adams is doing that.
Yeah.
When I think of like explosive... guys on SNL, you know, you think Belushi, you think Chris Farley.
For
you know.
The drug culture, yeah, of course.
You think of like, especially when you think of Belushi and Farley, just two examples, you think of like these explosive personalities on screen, okay? Like just, you could see the bundles of energy and it was unpredictable. You didn't know what they would do. You didn't know what would happen. And it didn't always turn out smoothly, but it was funny and it was electric. And there's a danger to those performances. Mm-hmm. But with Hammond, this is a crazy thing to me. With Hammond, I always considered him like the most reliable, consistent cast member.
He was the workhorse.
Yeah. He, going through all these troubles and in this book, like he talks about like living in crack dens while he was on SNL. Like,
I know,
that's
right?
Crazy. And yet, this guy came out week after week, the most reliable impressions.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's a good thing to remember as well. You know, we talk a lot in our society today about mental illness and people. I mean, you never know what anybody's dealing with when you encounter them, whether it's somebody you know or somebody you know bump into on the street. But it's a good reminder that people are dealing with stuff that you don't necessarily see on the outside, and it's not always what it seems. And you know, compassion and understanding is always a good thing. Two of my favorite things about this audiobook is just that, number one, that he is somebody who had the lowest possible lows and some of the highest highs. And even in his 60s now, he is still working to better himself. He's not saying, I'm done. Look, I'm good. I'm famous, so I'm okay now. He's still working physically, emotionally, mentally to better himself and showing that it can be done, that you're not a slave to your demons or to your past or anything like that. So I think it's a good motivational story for anyone who, you know, maybe feels like they need that same sort of, you know, sort of, I don't know what you would call it, but like a little pep up in their life, you know, something, you know, they need to start improving their own path.
Yeah, stop putting so much pressure on yourself and work on it, you know, one thing at a time.
Yeah.
And
And it's not too late. Like, he's in his 60s and he's still doing it. He's not saying, oh, well, I'm in my 60s, so what's the point? Like, this is who I am. No, it's never too late to better yourself. And also what you mentioned earlier, the audiobook is almost like a little performance because he does so many impressions in it. So it's a little bit different than maybe your normal audiobook, but it's a lot of fun and it's a good listen.
Yeah, it sounds great. Can't wait to listen to it.
Also,
sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say there's a question that he talks about in That's Clinton. He talks about the colonoscopy and we talked about it in the interview and we never got the answer as to what Bill Clinton says in the colonoscopy. And in the interview, I left a little dead air there for him to answer it, and he didn't. So I don't know if maybe he didn't want to do the impression on air or what have you. But if you hear That's Clinton, you'll get the full story, and it's quite funny.
I don't think he wanted to give the milk away when you get the cow for free, you know, whatever that saying is.
No. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't like asking people to, you know, you interview a singer. I don't want. Yeah. Why buy the milk if you have the cow at
thank
home?
Thank you. I was like, this is killing me. How come I can't get
or why? No. Was it? Or is it why buy
why
the cow
buy
if you get the
cow?
Milk for free?
Right. Why buy the cow when you get the milk for free?
Yeah.
That's it.
It's something about cows and milk. But yeah, I mean, as journalists, we don't ask a singer we're interviewing to sing. You don't ask a comedian to tell us a joke. You know, you just sort of, it's a respect thing. So, but if you listen to That's Clinton, you'll hear it, and it's really funny.
Okay, well, another great week, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I just hit my nose on the mic. And I'll
hit it. You just headbutted the microphone.
I sure did.
I don't remember. Are you supposed to do that in radio or no?
Well, yeah.
They encourage you to hit the microphone.
Yeah, encourage you to hit the microphone and for good luck, I think it is. And hey, audience, you know I have a head concussion right now, but please follow us on Stitcher and iTunes, Google Play. I have amnesia. I don't know if I've said this already earlier today.
You just said you have a head concussion. Like, what other kind of concussion would you have?
That's interesting.
You hit your head harder than I thought.
What other concussion could I have? I hit my head pretty much every day, Mike. If it isn't a day ending in day, if I have not hit my head.
We need to wrap this up before.
Yeah, let's wrap it up.
We need to get the plugs in.
So peeps, follow us there, please. Treatment. Follow us there, Mike. Okay, wrap it up.
Thank you so much to Daryl Hammond for his time. Thank you to Gina. We'll get you to the hospital as soon as this is over. And thanks to everyone for listening. And we'll see you next time on Ages and Icons.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.